From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is Cool Science Radio. Science and technology that's interesting, fun, and if we can understand it, so will you. I'm John Wells.
And I'm Lynn Ware-Peak.
Our first guest this morning, theoretical physicist Antonio Padilla, who has written Fantastic Numbers and Where to Find Them, A Cosmic Quest from Zero to Infinity. Padilla explores nine of the most extraordinary numbers in physics that illuminate the ultimate nature of reality.
Our second guest this morning is Dr. Gabby Wild. She's a National Geographic kids educator and author. And her latest book, How to Speak Animal, helps kids understand how animals communicate through sound, body language, and behavior. It's full of expert insights and real-life stories of humans exploring ways to talk to animals, from teaching great apes sign language to speaking dolphin.
Our first guest this morning is theoretical physicist Antonio Padilla, who has written Fantastic Numbers and Where to Find Them, A Cosmic Quest from Zero to Infinity. Padilla explores nine of the most extraordinary numbers in physics that illuminate the ultimate nature of reality. Antonio, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Hiya. You all right, John?
We really enjoyed the book, and I have to tell you, it's a bit of a love letter to numbers, mathematics, and the people that worked with these numbers. How did you get interested in all of this? How did you become so passionate about all of this?
Well, I've always sort of loved maths and numbers, and I think it was sort of, you know, and that was always enough for me in the beginning, just, you know, the beauty and the sort of elegance of mathematics. But I think it was when I went to university, and I actually talk about this in the book, and I did a proof that I had written out for one of the courseworks that we did. And I actually got given zero for this proof. And I was like, well, why is he giving me zero? And I looked, because all the arguments were correct, but he just didn't like how I'd laid it out on the piece of paper, right? And he was sort of trying to sort of instill this kind of like a mathematical pedantry in how I should sort of lay it out and how I should develop the logic. And whilst I thought that was, I mean, I got it, I think at that moment I thought, well, you know, for me, numbers really need a bit more personality than that. And I think where I found that personality was in physics. And I was sort of drawn then more and more to the sort of the applied side of mathematics and theoretical physics. And I really saw how physics could bring numbers alive. And I think, you know, when you start talking about extreme numbers like I do in the book, it naturally makes you think about extreme physics. And I've always been making my YouTube videos and things like that, I've always tried to think of, not just talk about a number, but think of a way in which you can try to insert it into our physical world and give it personality and bring it to life. And as I said, extreme numbers are always going to make you think about extreme physics, like black holes and cosmology and all that.
You know, about a year ago, actually it was 1 year ago, Lynn and I interviewed astronauts aboard the International Space Station. Oh, wow. It was traveling 17,500 miles an hour, and it was a couple hundred miles above our home planet here. People asked me afterwards, you know, why we didn't ask them about what it was like, you know, being weightless. And after reading your book and hearing from other people about this subject, they weren't actually weightless. They were basically constantly falling towards the horizon, and they were in orbit. And because they were falling, it gave them the appearance of being weightless. And this sort of ties together with a pretty wild statement you make in the book, that gravity is fake. And I was wondering if you could give us a little information about that.
Yeah, so this I start my course. I teach a fourth year course, fourth year university course on gravity, and I start with that little one liner, and it always upsets the students. Like, I think gravity is fake. This course is fake. But yeah, it's true. You can even, this really comes back to Einstein, right? And so we normally think of gravity. It's not really a force in the traditional sense of the other forces that we talk about in nature, like electromagnetic forces or even the nuclear forces that go on sort of deep inside an atom. It's really the curvature of space and time. And so it's somehow different in that sense. And what's really interesting about the kind of space-time that we live in, that we seem to live in, that the certain laws suggest we do live in, is that when you look at space-time over a really, really short distance, you can actually sort of do away with gravity altogether. And it's in the same sense that if you think of space and time as being curved, and that's what gravity is, well, if you think of the Earth as being curved, if you look, zoom right in, it's as if the Earth is flat, at least around you. It's only when you zoom out and look at the Earth from afar that you see it's curved. If you just look at it from deep within, it's as if it was flat, which is exactly why the ancients thought it was flat. It's the same with space-time. Locally, you know, zoomed in, space-time looks flat, but it's only when you zoom out that it looks curved. So you can do away with space-time just by zooming in. So that means you can do away with gravity just by zooming in. And you really can experience this. It's exactly what the astronauts on the space station are experiencing. I talk in the book about if you went up to the Burj Khalifa, which is the tallest building in the air in on Earth in Dubai, and if you got in a lift, it was blacked out, you couldn't see outside the windows, and somebody threw the lift off the building. It's quite drastic, of course. I'm not recommending anybody do this.
It's quite an experiment.
Yeah, very much so. Yeah, it's an experiment with not a great outcome. Then the lift will fall. It obviously accelerates due to gravity. And you will feel weightless in that lift because you'll also be accelerating with the lift due to gravity. So you'll feel like you're floating in the lift. You can feel this effect just by, you know, when you're in your car and you sort of, you know, you go down a steep hill a little bit too quickly, you feel that little weightlessness and you feel that sort of funny feeling in your tummy, right? And you're sort of feeling a little bit of weightlessness there. And it's because you're accelerating, with gravity. You're only really feeling gravity. There's a lift in UC Davis in the US, which I've visited many times. In the physics department there, in the lift in there, they have a little seat which kind of moves, and so you can feel, and it weighs you, so you can sit on it and you can feel like the change in the effect of gravity, how you go weightless between weightless when you're going downwards and you gain weight as you're going up in the lift. And it's just fun thing for the physicists there to sort of experience. Yeah. That standing right there.
What is that little device meant to measure?
It's measuring your effective weight, right? So the lift if you were literally to someone to cut the cable on the lift would accelerate due to gravity, and you were sitting in that chair, you'd effectively become weightless. Obviously there'd be a bit of air resistance, but if we neglect those sort of subtleties, yeah, effectively you'd become weightless. Whereas if you're going upwards, it's pushing against you, and you would feel more weight.
So what is it that you think, Antonio, that we, you know, the average person is missing about numbers? Because you're telling us where to find these numbers. What are we missing about it? Why are we not engaged in numbers the way you are?
Well, I think, at some level, sort of everyday life is just, you know, you deal with your sort of everyday numbers, right? The numbers that you see on a grocery receipt, or, you know, in the bills that you get. And they're not very exciting. They don't make anybody particularly excited or happy, right? And they're quite mundane numbers. But numbers, there's a lot of numbers out there. There's an infinite number of numbers out there, right? There's an infinite number of infinite numbers. So there's so much more to numbers. And when you start to reach into the sort of more extreme realms of number, and the thing, as I said, the thing that I always like to do is try to bring that into the physical world. So you talk about these numbers like Graham's number, which is the largest number ever to have appeared in a mathematical proof, or at least it used to be. It was in the record books for that. It's not enough just to say it's a big number. Yeah, it's a big number, but that's not very exciting. It's, okay, fine, we have big numbers. There's actually an infinite number that are bigger than it, but you really try to picture, well, what does this mean? What would happen if I put this into the physical world? And you start to think, well, okay, if I do that, then what would happen if I tried to think of this number? If I tried to imagine all its digits, you know, one by one written out in your head, and you realize that actually you couldn't do that because your head would have to collapse into a black hole before that could happen. So this is what physics gives you. It sort of almost sort of allows you to sort of really bring these numbers to life.
All over the cover of your book, you have zeros. Why zeros?
Yeah. Well, zero is a very beautiful number, I think. I talk about it as a number of beauty, which is kind of weird because I think medieval times, people thought the zero was quite sort of an evil number, actually. It was associated with kind of the, you know, the void, the absence of God, and those kind of things. And so to the medieval people, zero was something that was associated with the devil, for example, with evil. And it came from the East, and there was this sort of very much a resistance to in Western civilization about sort of taking on that on board. But of course they did in the end, but it was more because it was convenient for accountancy, actually, that they finally accepted it. But from a physicist point of view, which is kind of the angle I was always looking at it, what's beautiful and wonderful about zero is its symmetry. And symmetry is what dictates all of physics, or has in the last century. So why symmetry? Well, you know, zero is the only number that if you flip its sign, you get back the same thing. So if I take 5 and I flip the sign and I go to -5, I get a different number. If I go from 10, I go to -10, I get a different number. If I go to 0 and then I go to -0, well, -0 is just 0. So there's this symmetry under a sign flip. It's the only number that has this property. And actually, you can connect zero. Whenever you see a 0 in the physical world, something equates to 0. Its value is 0. I don't know. It could be the mass of the photon, for example, which is, you know, the particle of light that has 0 mass. That's always connected to symmetry. And so, and symmetry and these elegant structures that we see in physics, they actually underpin the whole structure of physics. So there's real beauty in that, especially from a theoretical physics point of view. There's a real beauty from that, and it's all tied in with the beautiful number that is 0.
Today's physicists, if they're a theoretical physicist, particle physicist, astrophysicist, they all stand on the shoulders of giants that came before them. And you certainly give all of those giants credit as you talk about Einstein and Maxwell and others that we've all heard about. But you brought up someone that I had never heard about and made really a significant contribution. It's Polish physicist Hermann Minkowski. Can you tell us what his contribution was?
Well, Minkowski was originally actually, he was Einstein's tutor. Actually, this is one of the funny things. He sort of came before Einstein. He taught Einstein, I think, in Zurich, if I remember rightly. And funnily enough, he called Einstein a lazy dog, actually. He had no interest in mathematics, apparently. But you know, Minkowski was also a very, very intelligent man. And he recognized when Einstein developed his ideas about time and space, you know, these ideas that time can tick at different speeds depending on whether sort of somebody is moving relative to somebody else, that this can lead to sort of changes in lengths, that lengths can contract depending on whether things are moving or not. So you've got all this sort of meddling of time and space doing weird and wonderful things that Einstein sort of thought through in relativity. And what Minkowski realized, obviously he was deeply aware of Einstein's work, even if he thought he was a lazy dog. He knew about and he recognized Einstein's genius. But what Minkowski realized is that this weirdness of time and weirdness of space and all these weird effects that you get at very high speeds, it's actually better understood in one unified object, which is space-time. So it's like a geometric object which connects space and time and brings them together into one object. And once you start thinking about that instead of just thinking about three-dimensional space and one dimension of time, you think about one unified object, which is four-dimensional space-time, you know, where you label it with three coordinates of space and also your time. When you put all that together and you get this new geometric object, you can then start to really build into what gravity is. And that's what inspired Einstein later to develop general relativity, where he understood gravity as being the shape of space-time. Not space, not time, but space-time. And it's really important to have the two together. And this idea of unifying ideas in physics is something that's really, it's gone on since Maxwell, really. It's sort of really kicked off since Maxwell. Maxwell obviously combined electricity and magnetism and made electromagnetism, the theory of electromagnetism. But bringing space and time together, it's another further unification. And whenever you do this, whenever you unify ideas in physics, you generally get more elegance, more beauty. The equations simplify. And you get this structure that appears that allows you to go further. So I think that's one really, the idea of space-time, and Minkowski's space-time in particular, is a really powerful one. And I think that's Minkowski's greatest legacy.
Well, Antonio, I believe that I live in a three-dimensional world, up and down, sideways and back. and forward and backwards. I believe I'm in a three-dimensional world. And I also understand what you're saying about space-time as the fourth dimension. We spoke earlier about gravity. Gravity is fake, you know, to get the attention of your graduate students that you're teaching. And I'm starting to understand that. But what I can't get my arms around is when you say in the book that gravity creates the third dimension, that we live in a holographic two-dimensional world. Lynn and I are flat. We're in two dimensions, and somehow it's gravity that gives that third dimension. And I just don't understand that. It's hard to get my head wrapped around. Can you help me with that?
Yeah. So, I don't think it's easy to get your head around. So fundamentally, what are we saying here? So firstly, it's a conjecture. So I should be clear about that. What we're talking about now is a conjecture, but it's a conjecture which has a growing amount of evidence. So what is the statement? It's the statement is that you take our world, which is, let's talk about space now, just for simplicity. So we've got our three dimensions of space, and we have a gravitational force that we can experience the physics of our world with, you know, all the forces, including gravity and three dimensions. That's what we need to, that's the mathematics that we need to encode the physics that we see, right? And it works well. It's nothing wrong with that. What the holographic conjecture says is that you don't actually need that to describe exactly the same physics. There is another language which is two-dimensional, so has two dimensions of space and has no gravity, in which you can describe exactly the same physical phenomena, albeit encoded in a very different way. So the analogy that you can draw is with a hologram. So there are two ways to think of what the information that's contained in a hologram. On the one hand, you have a holographic plate, right, which has a series of light and dark bands, and they are what they are. That contains some information to do with the image. It contains the information of the image. There's no more information than what's in that two-dimensional plate. But you shine monochromatic light through the holographic plate, and you can then start to see this three-dimensional image emerge. You've not created any new information. It's the same information, just encoded slightly differently or decoded slightly differently. And that's what we're conjecturing could be the case with gravity, that there are two descriptors. If you like, again, it's like a language. You can think of it like languages. In some sense, when I, you know, if I say a plate of meatballs in English, I'll say that's a plate of meatballs. If I want to say in Spanish, I'll say it's albóndigas. But they're exactly the same thing. They're not, in English and in Spanish, we're describing exactly the same object, just in a different way. And it's the same here. The idea is that we have, on the one hand, you can describe the physical phenomena that we see in our world using three dimensions of space and gravity and the force of gravity. However, there is another way to describe exactly the same physics, and that only requires two dimensions and no gravity. And that's absolutely remarkable. Now, the insight for this has come from black holes. Black holes, what we've realized, black holes are really sort of extremely gravitating objects. So gravity feels important for black holes, more so than it does in other environments. And what we've realized is that black holes seem to store their information on their surface. And this is what, and that surface, of course, is two-dimensional. So they're storing things in a way which feels a little bit more two-dimensional. And that was the sort of inspiration to develop this idea. And now there is strong evidence for this idea. There are actually examples of space times, not necessarily our world, but other world, other sort of, you know, sort of toy models, for example, that we often use in physics to get insight, but toy universes that you can imagine. And you can really show that, look, here's something that you can calculate in this toy universe. And I can calculate this physical effect, and I can use gravity, and I can use all the dimensions of space, or I can do exactly the same calculation in a completely different language and get the same answer. And so the conjecture is that this would also be true of our universe. And it's absolutely mind-blowing, I agree, to think that the third dimension could be absolutely just an illusion. But ultimately, it's just a different language.
Tony, that is really mind-boggling for this very early hour.
Yeah, wait a little bit later in space time for these thoughts.
Exactly. Well, okay, you said you're a bit of a YouTube star. And I'm wondering how you come up with your topics. You don't get to be a YouTube star without Well, as you said, to present these topics in sort of an irreverent way, which I love, which most people love. And I'm just wondering how you decide to present your topic. If you have your YouTube channel and you don't really have an audience at the time to read the looks on their face or the way they're receiving the information you're handing out, how do you decide how to bring this kind of information to people like John and to me?
Yeah, so obviously I work with Brady Haran, who sort of owns the channel Number File 60 Symbols that I appear on, and Brady's great, right? He's so he's always there in the room with me, and he's asking questions. Generally, I will come up with the topics when we make a video, and I will always do that thing, especially particularly for the sort of numerical ones. I always try to sort of bring physics to the table. It's kind of like, I don't know, it's what I do. It's my thing, right? And so when we, you know, we'll talk and I will normally go off on one from the get-go, and then Brady tries to reel me in, and then the conversation, and he always asks, because he's not a trained physicist, but he enjoys physics and he likes the ideas in mathematics as well. But he asks the questions I think the viewers would ask. And that's why it works, I think. That's why it kind of, it seems to work for us. So yeah, so I do have an audience. It's Brady, basically. And if I say something that doesn't make any sense, I'll get a face pulled. And so I get that feedback. So yeah, that's kind of how it goes.
Talk to us about Graham's number. It's so large that if you think about it in the wrong way, your head would collapse into a singularity. What does that mean? And what is Graham's number?
Yeah, so Graham's number, you know, as I said, it goes back to a proof that was written in the 1970s by a American mathematician known as Ron Graham, who passed away quite recently, actually. And it's a problem in something called Ramsey theory, which is a branch of mathematics where you think about sort of finding order in chaos. So you look for structure in something that looks seemingly chaotic. It's that branch of mathematics. The details don't matter so much. But what Graham found was this, he was trying to sort of, he's working with things called hypercubes, and he was looking for a limit, looking for sort of like a largest thing that this, you know, largest number that this thing he was after could be. And it was this huge number. It was this huge number. And I don't just mean huge in the way that a billion is huge or a trillion is huge or even a quadrillion is huge or Google. It's beyond, way beyond those numbers, way beyond them. You can't really think of them using sort of conventional maths. You need to sort of develop new mathematics to sort of describe them in any kind of efficient way. But what I recognized was, well, people don't normally think of numbers in these exotic and strange mathematical ways. They normally think of them in the way you just think of the number written out, right? So I thought, well, what if we thought of Graham's number written out? What would happen? Well, the thing is, each digit in Graham's number, and you can really think of it as a random assortment of a huge number of digits. Each digit of Graham's number contains some information. That's information that's going to go into your head when you start to picture it. And the thing about information is that information actually weighs. And sort of intuitively, you can think of this, like if you sort of, you know, add some information, like a text message arrives on your iPhone or other phones are available, of course. But, you know, if some information appears on your iPhone, then, you know, the electrons in the electron trap will change their energy levels to store that information. And that changes the weight of the phone ever so slightly. But it does change it. So information actually weighs. So every time you put a digit of Graham's number in your head, you're adding a little bit of mass to your brain. Okay, so if you start adding too much of it, and so these digits keep coming in, they keep coming in, right? And what's going to happen is eventually you're going to add so much mass to your brain that your brain's going to start to heat up. It's going to want to explode, to be fair. But what I imagine is if we could somehow stop your head from exploding, if we could somehow get reinforced skull or something like that, then even before you even scrape the surface of Graham's number, you would reach a limit where the only object the size of your head capable of containing so many digits would be a black hole, because black holes are the best storers of information that you can have They really are. You know, they're the things that are able to contain an awful lot of mass in a very small space, and that allows them to store a lot of information. So you just, long before you reach Graham's number, your head would inevitably collapse to form a black hole, and there's just no avoiding it.
Antonio, we are almost out of time, and I'm sorry I've asked so many questions about gravity. I've just been thinking about it a lot lately, and your book has really sort of inspired me to look a little closer. And I just have one final question before we let you go, and that is our understanding of gravity under fire right now as we try to get a better sense of dark energy and dark matter that may be inconsistent with what Einstein came up with?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. It's something that I've thought about a lot. So indeed, what you say is true, that dark energy, which tells us about how the universe is behaving on very, very large scales, so very, you know, cosmological distances, we see that the expansion of the universe is accelerating. It's getting quicker and quicker. And that's counterintuitive, because you normally think that gravity attracts. So if anything, it should slow down the expansion, but something's forcing it to speed up. And you need quite exotic fluids to achieve that within standard general relativity. So it's not impossible. You can just use the energy of empty space to do it. But then there are puzzles about how much energy there is. And when it comes together, you start to wonder whether maybe there's a little problem with Einstein's theory itself, that maybe it's breaking down on the very, very large scales. It's certainly an active area of research. Whether it's true or not, we don't know yet. I mean, people are looking for evidence of it. But there is historical precedent here, of course. You know, when Mercury's orbit has this sort of strange precession. So the ellipse which it follows moves with time. And if you try to calculate how it moves with time using Newtonian theory, the theory of gravity laid down by Isaac Newton, then what you find is you get the wrong answers based on the planets that you see. So what people assumed at the time was that there must be another planet that we don't see that's called Vulcan, actually. And this planet would just correct the orbit of Mercury just right so that you could get what you see from Newtonian theory. But of course, the planet Vulcan, despite many false alarms, does not exist. It's not there. It was just a fudge. It's literally a dark planet which doesn't exist. What corrects the story is a new theory of gravity, which was Einstein's theory. Einstein's theory, the corrections that come from that actually fix all the numbers based on the other planets that you can see, and they correct, you get the right number for the shape of Mercury's orbit. So you'd sort of tempted to wonder, is something similar happening today? Are we seeing all these sort of problems with gravity and you know, sort of lining up with Einstein's theory at very, very large cosmological scales? And we talk about, well, we need this dark energy to sort of fudge it, but maybe we need a new theory of gravity. The problem is, the minute you try to meddle with Einstein's theory, all hell breaks loose. You know, you release all sorts of things that you don't want in the theory, instabilities, you know, catastrophes of various forms, and that's the challenge. So it's a great theory, Einstein's theory, and to modify it is tricky.
Antonio Padilla, theoretical physicist, podcast recorder, has written a fantastic book called Fantastic Numbers and Where to Find Them, A Cosmic Quest from Zero to Infinity. We want to thank you so much for joining us this morning on Cool Science Radio. We've really enjoyed the conversation.
Thanks, guys. I enjoyed it too.
Okay.
Our next guest is Dr. Gabby Wild. She is a Nat Geo kids educator and author, and her latest book, How to Speak Animal, helps kids understand how animals communicate through sound, body, language, and behavior. It's full of expert insights and real-life stories of humans exploring ways to, quote-unquote, talk to animals, from teaching great apes sign language to speaking dolphin. Dr. Wild, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, let's just start here. We were sort of joking around beforehand about how doing interviews via Zoom, there's always something that complicates what we're trying to do. It seems so simple. And if only we were animals, we would have a much easier way of communicating overall. Do you really believe that as
a doctor of someone who speaks to animals.
Exactly. You know, I do think that animals have figured out how to speak to one another and express themselves pretty darn well. That's how they've evolved to be where they are right now. If they were unsuccessful, then they would be extinct. And what does it mean to be successful? Get food, survive, and mate. Because you got to do all those things in order to keep a population going. And these species have all figured it out pretty nicely. What makes it different about us versus them is our language is very complex. And the word language is a very delicate word that we really didn't want to utilize in this book or really go into. But because our language is so complex and we have different nuances, you could say the same thing in so many different ways, I'm sure, with friends and relationships and in communication when talking to audiences, you want to say it in just the right way so things don't get misconstrued. With animals, the way we study it is a certain call or a certain behavior equals this kind of outcome. So that call means danger, things of that nature. So we find that their way of communication, if you will, is a little bit more efficient, a little bit more direct, and results in things that lead to their survival.
It's so interesting, Gabby, and I think any of us who has a dog, for example, at home, my dog has various ways of communicating with me, and I'm amazed at how subtle they are sometimes, but I know what this dog, what he means, what he's trying to communicate. And it must just be so fascinating. I'm curious, what prompted in you this desire to learn how animals communicate?
Absolutely. I would say I've always wanted to be a vet. And in order to be a doctor, you have to help your patient. And I'm a wildlife vet. And if I don't know how my patients act behaviorally, because a lot of communication is behavior. It's not entirely, but a lot of it deals with behavior. If I don't understand how they're communicating to me or to one another or to other species or how they act in their environment, I'm not going to be able to be a very good doctor. You can go ahead and have your doctor say, okay, can you please stand up? I'm going to listen to your lungs, take a nice deep breath. I can't usually do that to my patients. I've got to either anesthetize them or really very carefully do things in a manner that they feel comfortable and safe, depending on the species. And so in order to do that, I need to know what are their fears and what can I do to mollify them? And what's the surrounding? So the way I treat a tiger in the wild is very different than the way in which I would do so in a captive setting, like in a zoo. Because they're around people and they've learned and they've actually have been positively conditioned to be around people and to tolerate me.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we are speaking with Dr. Gabby Wild. She's a Nat Geo kids educator and author. Her latest book, How to Speak Animal, helps kids understand how animals communicate through sound, body, language, and behavior. Gabby, a gentleman that I have interviewed a couple times, Dr. Khan Shlabajikov in Arizona. I don't know if you know him or not, but he started studying prairie dogs about 30 years ago, and he would bring equipment out to the desert in South Arizona, and he would record them when certain things would happen. He would observe a coyote would show up and they'd pop their head out and they would communicate with the other prairie dogs. He would go back into his lab and they got a bunch of people from computer science trying to suss out what was going on. And over time, they found out that not only could the prairie dog ascertain if a coyote was walking through the desert and coming towards them, but also if it was a man. And then they found out if it was a fat man or a skinny man, they could communicate that. If it was a red shirt versus a blue shirt. I mean, all this granularity and detail that they came up with. And it just amazed me that they could communicate in that level. Have you had that experience as well with your studying?
Absolutely. And we actually, I'm embarrassed to say, although I didn't pick up that very unique name when you first said it, I know of his study.
Oh, yes.
And we have it in the book. So we discuss prairie dogs in our book. And you have to think of it this way. When you have so many species, so many animals living together. These little guys are hundreds, if not thousands sometimes, in burrows living together. They have to find ways to communicate and protect one another because they are stronger in numbers. And they work together to create these underground cities that are huge, that are absolutely huge. And if they don't find ways to discuss these nuances with one another, they're not going to succeed. They will fail. Now, what is so interesting is we have to imagine that they evolved somehow a way to communicate and learn how to identify things. It's not this Lamarckian system where, oh, they're evolving to do. No, they became the prairie dog because they're able to see things and note it, and they have the ability to recognize something new. They have the ability to translate it into another call signal, and they all have the ability to then know what that call signal means and essentially learn it. So that within itself is so unique because not every species could do that. And that's what makes them so, if you will, on the human level of IQ, according to us, really intelligent. But according to them, whether they can or cannot do it, we know that they can, they are perfect for exactly what they do. And that's something that I really like to emphasize because I see animals communicating and learning different things. My favorite, to talk about the lyrebirds, 80% of a lyrebird song is all mimicked. It's not even anything unique to a lyrebird. When I say mimicked, a car alarm, they're doing a little mating dance and you hear like a car alarm going on and a chainsaw and like beeping and camera that they're literally mimicking. And it's hilarious because they've learned to mimic and they apply it and they're like, I like this fun sound. And then they put it into their own songs. So it's really cool to see all of that happening. And I see animals communicating in such unique ways and developing, if you will, new words. I say that in quotation marks, developing new words, new calls, new signals, new forms of communication. That's them evolving. That's them evolving. And if you will, they're coining, I dare not say that with other scientists on the line, but coining new ways to communicate to one another. And it's incredible. And I think as we begin to encroach on their lands and have more effects on them, more than we really want, the ones who are able to adapt to us will survive. And the ones that cannot adapt to our deleterious effects that we have on them are going extinct.
With technology changing so rapidly, do you think we'll ever get to the point where there'll be a black box that will allow us to have some sort of effective conversation with our domestic dogs?
I don't know if we want to know what they're saying. It might be a bit more overwhelming. I feel like we're already overwhelmed by our computers telling us too much information to be truthful. Like, hang tight. I was talking to my friend about sofas. I don't need a sofa. So, yeah. But that being said, will there be a black hole? Very well, there might be. There very well might be. We have so many studies going on that I think there very well might be a technology that comes out that can better help us and better translate things. Who knows? But whether a call is unanimous across species remains to be seen. Some things are very unique that animal has come up with, similar to like the sound of our voice. So the Siri will have to listen to the voice identification of your dog to know what's your accent, what's your voice sound like. My Siri still hasn't picked up my accent. She always gets things wrong. But it's very possible. I mean, when you said the black box, the first thing I actually thought of were the studies that we're doing right now with elephants, specifically forest elephants, and how we've been recording their sounds in the forest, and how most of their sounds are actually an infrasound, and how we take those infrasounds and we use technology to convert it to a sound that we can actually listen to and hear. And then we've been trying to associate when this sound happens, what are they all doing? What's going on when that happens? So that's how we've been trying to determine what these, we call them rumbles, what these rumbles really mean. So yeah, in certain ways, we're already using a black box.
Certainly we are. And it reminds me of
you know, when you're in a country where you don't speak the language, now you can just speak in English or whatever your native language is into the phone, and it pops out with the new language. And it's sounding very reminiscent of that as you speak about these animals. You brought up the case for elephants, and I have to ask you about this. You, as a wildlife veterinarian, have given acupuncture to elephants. Please tell us, how does that work?
Absolutely. So it works if they are willing to receive it. So I don't usually do it on wild elephants. I've been doing it mainly on, if you will, domesticated elephants that are mainly in rescues, zoos, or owned by mahouts. And I'm the first one in the past 3,000 years to be doing acupuncture on elephants. And my mentor, Dr. Che, in the Qi Institute, helped me take these ancient charts, because I don't speak Mandarin, and he translated it so we could re-find these points and start using it into these charts. And the way it works is the elephant stands still, and I start first with every species I work with, there are permission points and then points of relaxation. So I first start with those points, and it's really funny because I'll do it for people to watch, and I've done it for veterinary students and such as well. And they all go, wow, they're so relaxed all of a sudden. I'm like, yep, that was the first point. That was my permission point. And the next serve points to absolutely relax them. And then you'll notice that they start to feel really like, they sometimes they close their eyes and they're getting all like sleepy and relaxed. And then when I do the acupuncture, I really use it as an adjunctive. I'm not using it as my primary mode of medication. It's just that sometimes I might not have the medication that I need, either because it's too expensive, it needs to be refrigerated and I'm out in the boonies, or we didn't have enough money. Nobody donated enough for me to provide that medication yet, and I'll have to come back out with it. And if I have my needles, that's pretty cheap. And certain maladies, I'll be honest with you, we have no studies to prove that certain maladies, acupuncture works for it. Pain, I love using it for pain. But if I have nothing else and I'm suspicious of malady X, I say, you know what, I'll give this medication that I do have. Hopefully that can work until we get more test results. Let's see. But you know what, I'm here, let me throw some needle. Let's just see. Let's see if I can hit some of the immune spots for like an infection or something and see if that helps you. Who knows? I don't know, but better to try than to not try.
Well, and it's the same reason that we as humans get acupuncture. It, you know, based on the meridians and the flow of your chi and pain trigger points and all of that. So you mentioned you're the first person in 3,000 years. And so what you're saying is these ancient charts in Mandarin show where those acupuncture points are, suggesting that it was done before 3,000 years ago. That's incredible.
Yes. And they translated it from human to then horse to then elephant and then dog.
Gabby, what percentage of communication is body language, and what percentage is sound, and what percentage might be behavior?
So different depending on the species. Some species, all they use is chemical. That's how they speak. Some species, all they use is visual. And some species, all they use is auditory, or it might be tactile. But most have a mix of each, and it just depends per species.
When I tell my dog Porkchop that we're going to the beach, he gets pretty excited.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, he's a cute dog. And he gets excited when I tell him we're going to the beach. But when I tell him we're going to the beach and we're going to meet my daughter, Jacqueline, he cocks his head to the side. And I just have this sense that he's trying to figure out that additional piece of communication. But a lot of dogs cock their head to the back and forth to the side. What is that? What are they doing?
That's him possibly saying, okay. Like, I don't exactly know what's going on. Generally speaking, when they know what's up, and they think they know what's up, I should say, they either are going to show you a very direct response of excitement or moving to the door, wagging their tail, because they recognize the word beach, and they recognize go beach usually. You know, those are like those things. And then there's this other thing, and they don't know. So Are you, because they don't understand we, they don't understand language. They understand certain commands, certain words, not all of this kind of syntax. So if you're saying to them, Jacqueline, he might know who Jacqueline is, but he might be thinking, she's going to the beach. That's not fair. You know? So that might be what's going there. So if you maybe, I don't know if it's possible, but you could say, we're going to the beach. And then later, give him some time, Jacqueline, you know, Jacqueline just pointing. And maybe he'll understand, oh, she's there. Maybe he can associate. Who knows?
Okay, I'll try it.
That is so great. They say that, I think it's border collies, they're so smart, they can have up to something like 100 word vocabulary that they understand. What other animal amazes us for their understanding of when we speak and their ability to learn from our language? What's the volume of words that they know?
One would be dolphins, and we go into that in the book, but the one that I am always beyond fascinated with are the higher primates, gorilla, chimpanzee, and bonobo. And I'm sure you heard, the studies first started, I should say, in the 60s, where there was a 10-month-old chimp named Washu. I'm not entirely certain of how the studies commenced and why they commenced. I think it was to learn about language itself. And Washu learned ASL. And she was able to make all of these signs and completely communicate her wants, her wishes. And it was incredible. And that later evolved to allow them to do it in gorilla. And the first gorilla was Coco. Coco received a lot of attention for what she did. And then she taught another. So this is the next cool thing. She taught another gorilla ASL. And just, you know, Washu, there were other chimpanzees that were learning ASL, and they could actually sign to each other. But the experience of Coco was a bit mind-blowing, because she actually started to make words that she never knew. She was able to associate things. So I wrote in the book that she would say, she saw her handler wearing a ring. She didn't know how to say that. So she said to them, finger bracelet. And that's how she associated with it. And she started to use that. She created her own word for it to describe. And it's quite fascinating to learn this. And they say that she was at around the age of a 3.5-year-old in her ability to speak sign language. And today we have a bonobo that's currently doing it. And so these are ways in which they can communicate with us using a language we understand. Now, the big issue is we're forcing them to speak a language for us, but what about their language? Don't we want to just appreciate what they're saying? And maybe they don't want us to be hearing their conversation. We're eavesdropping.
That's a really good point. Now, you mentioned dolphins, and you talk in your book, I believe, about how we can learn their dolphin speak, their dolphin language.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. What does it sound like? Can you give us a sample?
Yes, I can't do it. No, but they do a lot of these beautiful high-pitched sounds. And what studies have been doing is that they will make a sound and using a special device, and that sound represents an object. And they're given a command to go ahead and go find that object. And it's interesting because the utility of it is that the Army has even been using this in order to scout for things in these waters, and to essentially use dolphins as spies and to investigate, if you will. So that's interesting. Are you there? Did I just lose you?
No, we are here.
Oh, you're there. Sorry, my screen just froze. I'm like, oh no. But yes. So that's the main utility that people have been using the dolphins for. But the studies themselves have just been elucidating to us how dolphins are able to speak and communicate. The device that they've been using is called CHAT. It stands for cetacean hearing and telemetry. And it'll kind of guide them to where they want to go find something. And these are basically artificial whistle sounds, because the sound that I made so annoyingly sounds like a high-pitched whistle. And that's how they've been communicating with them. And dolphins are absolutely brilliant. And they pick up more than we give them credit for, probably.
watching Netflix's Octopus, My Teacher, hearing your stories about the dolphin and the higher primates, we're learning more about the possibility that there are more sentient beings out there besides humans. What is the actual definition of a sentient being?
I believe a definition is something that is alive. That would be a sentient being. And then the question is, what is life? Because there's a debate about, is a virus something that is alive? And there's certain qualifications that come in for life. And those, you know, range from the ability to reproduce to a variety of things. So I think right now when we talk about sentient life, when we're doing that, it's more about trying to find living things like in other planets and such, you know, in that regard. But the animals, when we talk about communication, all of these things are sentient. Even an amoeba, you know, it's sentient. And I'm sure even amoebas are able to communicate with one another. I personally don't know all the methods of communication because I've never really treated an amoeba before. But yeah, I'd have to throw all those things that I learned in biology at you, and I have to keep them on the top of my brain of what qualifies life.
I just want to share something that I heard once. Somebody said, out in the middle of the ocean, there is a dolphin that is cresting, coming out of the water at a dark, dark night. And he sees, the dolphin sees all the stars, and the dolphin says to itself, "We have to go there."
It's beautiful.
Yeah, it's kind of cool.
It's very beautiful. It is a cool thought. Very cool. Yeah.
Well, Dr. Gabby Wild is a Nat Geo's kids educator and author. Her latest book, How to Speak Animal. We want to thank you so much, Dr. Wild, for joining us this morning. And we wish you continued success with your work and with your book.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure coming, and thank you for having me.
Thank you, Gabby.